The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'm going to be reading articles initially from the Harvard Health Letter. This is the September 2023 issue. And the first thing I'm going to go over is Ask the Doctor by Dr. Anthony Komaroff, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Health Letter. The question is, I take a daily multivitamin, although I know there's no proof it's good for me, but I recently heard it may help my brain. Tell me it's true. And Dr. Komaroff says, it might be. Early in 2023, two randomized controlled trials of a multivitamin pill containing over 20 vitamins and minerals got my attention. Randomized control trials are the best way to determine whether a treatment is effective. On April 10, 2023, the results of a trial involving over 2,200 people, average age 71, was published online by the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia. At the start of the study, the people who were assigned to take the multivitamin were very similar to those assigned to take the placebo with regard to their education and risk factors and their performance on tests of different aspects of cognition. After 3 years, those who had taken the multivitamin had better scores on cognition testing than those who had taken the placebo, particularly those people who had known cardiovascular disease. On May 24, 2023, a second trial was published online by the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. The study included 3,500 older people, average age 73, without any known cardiovascular disease. As with the earlier study, the participants were very similar initially, both educationally and cognitively. After 3 years, the people taking the multivitamin performed better on tests of memory than the people taking the placebo, although they performed similarly on tests of cognition other than memory. These are the only large randomized controlled trials that tested the effects of a multivitamin pill on cognition. They indicate that people older than 60 who take a multivitamin are less likely to experience cognitive decline, at least over the next 3 years, compared with those taking a placebo. The benefit appeared to be particularly true for people who have cardiovascular disease. These studies do not answer a number of important questions. Which of the vitamins and minerals included in the pill caused the benefits? One of the leaders of the study, Dr. Joanne Manson, professor of medicine and epidemiology at Harvard and a member of the Harvard Health Letter editorial board, speculates that the B vitamins, vitamin D, lutein, zinc, and magnesium may be responsible. Will this benefit persist if people take the pill for longer than 3 years? Will daily multivitamins protect against getting dementia, as well as protecting against age-related cognitive decline? The only way to answer these questions is with more research. That certainly is an interesting finding. Now, here's another interesting article in the Harvard Health Letter. It's entitled, Ways to Regain Your Sense of Smell. Sniffing peanut butter, peppermint, and other strong scents may help you retrain your brain and restore your sense of smell. Your smell sense gives you a superpower. Without moving a muscle or opening your eyes, it helps you to detect danger, store or trigger memories, discern flavors, or get a rush of feel-good chemicals during a meal. So you can imagine that losing your sense of smell, which is called anosmia, can be devastating. Many millions of people have been experiencing it as a common side effect of COVID-19. Other conditions can also lead to anosmia. When it occurs, you need to try to regain the sense as soon as possible. The longer you go without it, the less likely you are to recover it, says Dr. Neil Bhattacharya, an ear, nose, and throat specialist at the Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Why'd you lose it? Your sense of smell is made possible by your olfactory system. This includes thousands of sensory cells in the nasal cavity that detect odors and send information to the brain via olfactory nerves. If the olfactory nerves become inflamed or damaged, they may not function properly, and you may lose your sense of smell. Causes of anosmia include nasal polyps, sinus problems, head trauma, chemotherapy side effects, brain tumors, neurologic conditions, or viral infections. Why might a viral infection affect the sense of smell? Some viruses infect the olfactory nerves or the cells near them, attack them, and damage them, Dr. Bhattacharya says. It could also be that inflammation surrounding the nerves causes damage. Anosmia has serious consequences. It shuts down your ability to sniff out hazardous odors and steals much of your ability to taste and appreciate food. Loss of taste occurs because your olfactory sensory cells are responsible for most of your perception of flavor. The taste buds in your tongue detect whether a food is sweet, salty, sour, bitter, or savory. When everything tastes like cardboard, you lose the pleasure of eating. It hurts your quality of life. I have a patient whose wife is an exceptionally good cook. When he first lost his smell and taste senses, he ate less, lost 50 pounds, and became depressed. Now he's underweight. If you have anosmia from a chronic neurologic problem like Parkinson's disease, Dr. Bhattacharya says the chance of recovering your smell sense aren't great. If anosmia is due to a temporary condition like COVID-19, the chances are better that your sense of smell will return in a few months. For example, a study conducted by Dr. Bhattacharya and his colleagues, which was published in Laryngoscope, found that about 21 million Americans reported losing smell and taste from COVID in 2021, and almost 30% said they still haven't fully regained the sense about 12 to 18 months later. But Dr. Bhattacharya says the sense of smell is neuroplastic, meaning it sometimes regenerates. If you lost your sense of smell, don't wait around for it to come back. We used to tell people to wait 6 months before you came to see us, but now we want you to begin smell retraining as soon as possible. Smell retraining is simply a matter of sniffing a wide variety of odor-generating elements. About 6 to 10 different types of scents will do, like lemons or oranges, flowery perfumes, peanut butter, eucalyptus, rosemary, cinnamon, pine, peppermint, or cloves. You can use materials that you have at home or buy a smell retraining kit online, commonly found on Amazon.com, for $15 to $35. Once or twice a day, smell each scent for 30 seconds to 2 minutes. As you do, think about what you're smelling and try to recall moments when you've smelled this before. Cut open an orange, inhale its aroma, and think about another time when you savored a fresh, delicious orange. That triggers odor particle recognition. It's deeply seated in the brain, but you have to stimulate it to reestablish function. Try this therapy every day for at least 4 weeks, Dr. Bhattacharya suggests. If your smell sense doesn't return, see an otolaryngologist to rule out underlying conditions that may be causing anosmia. Treating an underlying condition may restore your sense of smell. And if you can smell again, you'll be able to taste and enjoy food again and restore your quality of life. Now, here's yet another rather interesting article. It's called Steps to Spot the Signs of Hoarding. What's normal and what isn't? Learn to identify this mental health disorder, which has serious risks. When Anne turned 66 last year, she began stockpiling plastic food containers. This initially made sense to her husband, since there would never seem to be a container available to store dinner leftovers. A year later, however, containers are spilling out of cabinets and closets and piling up in the laundry room. Anne also has started to collect paper bags, and Anne's husband is concerned she might have a condition called hoarding disorder. He could be right. Hoarding disorder is a mental health condition characterized by an inability to discard certain belongings to the point of unhealthy accumulation. While the types of hoarded items vary and might be useless to others, old clothes, boxes, papers, junk mail, or even spoiled food or garbage, the person hoarding the items is convinced that they'll be needed one day. The mere idea of parting with them is extremely distressing. In time, stuff fills the home in mounds of disorganized clutter that jam rooms and hallways, impairs daily function, and threatens safety. There might be clutter blocking the stove so you can't prepare meals, or blocking the door so you can't get to work or get out in an emergency, says Dr. Stephanie Collier, a psychiatrist at Harvard-affiliated McLean Hospital. It's unclear what causes hoarding disorder. It typically develops in the teen years, but can also show up in older age, possibly because hoarding is associated with certain mental health conditions. These include anxiety, dementia, obsessive-compulsive disorder, depression, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Features of those conditions sometimes trigger hoarding behavior. People with anxiety disorder might worry excessively that they'll run out of a particular object they're going to need. Building up a supply gives them a sense of control. People with OCD might have thoughts that won't go away about needing objects in certain amounts. They continually feel compelled to keep the objects even though they don't want to. Other examples, people with ADHD might have difficulty prioritizing what to throw out, and people with cognitive decline might be afraid to let go of certain items like bills because they can't remember if they need them. Signs of hoarding disorder develop gradually, making it hard to pick up on them until belongings accumulate. After all, maybe someone just wants to be prepared with supplies. How can you tell the difference between normal and abnormal accumulation? First of all, you should look for overkill. It's normal if there's a pile of bills on the desk, but not normal if bills cover every surface in the home and are stashed in bags or boxes. It's normal if there are a few cases of water bottles in the garage, but not normal if there's more water than someone could consume in a year. Also, watch for signs of impairment, like a loved one who's losing sleep thinking about his or her belongings, struggling to stay focused, tripping over clutter, keeping others out of the home, maybe because of a sense of shame, staying home more, and isolating from others. In the case of Anne, any of these symptoms, along with the accumulation of goods, could indicate that she's in the early stage of hoarding disorder. But it will take a therapist diagnosis to know for sure. If you suspect a loved one is hoarding, be gentle. Ask with compassion if the volume of belongings distresses the person. Would they like to consult a doctor or therapist? Seeking individual or group therapy can help, Dr. Collier says. If you suspect a memory problem, Dr. Collier advises you discuss your concerns with the person's doctor directly. Don't get rid of any items that aren't causing problems. Removing them too soon could create more distress for your loved one. It will be necessary to regularly throw out the trash every week, clear pathways when they're blocked, and replace rotting food with fresh food. Hoarders also tend to lose things. Obtain and stow duplicates of important items. Get extra things that will get misplaced, like glasses or keys. Keep them in a dedicated drawer. Doing these things for your loved one will help him or her manage hoarding and improve the person's quality of life as well as your own. Now, here's an article entitled, Three Group Housing Trends for the 60s and Older Set. The kids are grown, the house is empty, and you and your partner are wondering if you'll be spending the next few decades living alone, risking loneliness, social isolation, and chronic health problems. If the prospect is unappealing, you have options, and they're not limited to retirement facilities. Here are three trends. The first is specialized communities. A specialized community is sort of a mini neighborhood with dwellings clustered around common spaces. The units might be individual houses or cottages built around a recreational area, a garden, parking, and a common house for gatherings and planned activities. Or they could be apartments in a tall building with a courtyard and a common house on the first floor. The communities are run by the people who live there or by nonprofit organizations. Residents might own their homes or rent them. There are several different types of specialized communities, like those that are intergenerational with a mix of young families and older adults, and those that are only for people aged 55 and older. There are also those that are mission-oriented, with everyone in the community committed to a shared goal, like providing stable lives for foster children. The children would live with young families and interact with older residents regularly. These communities might be more affordable than traditional housing. They promote socialization and active involvement with neighbors. People look out for each other and share activities. They might drive a neighbor to a doctor's appointment or maybe help kids with homework. We've heard many reports of people benefiting from the model, said Jennifer Malinsky at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. She leads research exploring housing challenges for the aging population. Hundreds of these communities are established in the United States or just being built. For more information, visit the Co-Housing Association. That's at www.cohousing.org, and co-housing is spelled C-O-H-O-U-S-I-N-G. For many people, sharing a home with other adults makes good sense. They can take on a boarder, earn money to help pay the bills, and gain instant companionship. You can find mature boarders through groups like Silver Nest or the New York Foundation for Senior Citizens. The groups help you list your space, conduct background checks on potential boarders, set up leases, and more. There are also companies that connect you to younger boarders. For example, Nesterly helps older homeowners rent space at below market prices to young adults, like graduate students who agree to pay rent and help out around the house. These engagements can be very meaningful. Students might not know anyone when they get to town, and they find a home and friendship with an older person or couple. For the homeowners, it's someone to help out with chores or share meals with you. If you're uncomfortable sharing your home with strangers, consider sharing a home with friends or siblings. You might charge rent, or you could even buy a home together. Another benefit of living with friends or siblings is sharing the cost of services you may both need, like a private duty care for help with daily activities, like dressing or cooking. And then there are residential care homes. If you need more than just part-time assistance and you'd like to live with others in a homey atmosphere, consider a residential care home. It's set up like a small assisted living facility in a private home that's licensed by your state. A group home looks like any other house on the block, but inside has 4 to 10 residents and qualified staffers available 24 hours a day. Some staffers might live there. Services include assistance with bathing, dressing, meal prep, cleaning, and transportation. Each resident has a private or shared bedroom and bath. There are also common areas like a kitchen and a living room. The setting naturally invites socializing, friendship, and quality time. Costs are pretty much similar to assisted living, starting at about $3,000 per month, and are based on the amount of care you need. Don't wait to figure out your future housing. Look ahead. Think about what you might need and want in the future, including opportunities for socializing, help around the house, or added income. Consider your finances and your circumstances and start investigating while you have time to plan. It's best to be proactive. Now here's some news briefs from the Harvard Health Letter of September 2023. Exercise is tied to reduced risk of dying from flu or pneumonia. Here's some motivation to keep exercising this fall and winter. Exercise, even just a little, is linked to significantly lower risk of death from flu or pneumonia, according to a study published online in May 16, 2023 by the British Journal of Sports Medicine. Researchers evaluated the survey responses of more than 577,000 adults who reported their health and exercise habits and were followed for 9 years. Compared with people who said they didn't meet the guidelines for weekly physical activity, 150 minutes of aerobic exercise like brisk walking, plus two or more sessions for muscle strengthening, people who said they met both guidelines had a 48% lower risk of dying from flu or pneumonia during the study period. Even if participants reported doing only aerobic exercise below recommended amounts, the risk of dying from flu or pneumonia was still 21% lower compared with people who didn't exercise. The study was observational and doesn't prove that exercise prevents these deaths in people who get sick. But study authors say the link is plausible because exercise is associated with strong immune systems and lower rate of heart disease and stroke. So even if you aren't up to meeting exercise recommendations, remember that any activity that works your heart and lungs could have a big payoff for you this winter and all year long. Here's an encouraging finding. Early breast cancer survival rates are increasing. Encouraging news about breast cancer survival. Most women treated for early breast cancer are likely to become long-term survivors, according to a study published online June 13, 2023, by the BMJ. Researchers analyzed the health data of more than 512,000 British women who had been diagnosed with early breast cancer, confined to one breast and possibly the lymph nodes under an arm, between 1993 and 2015. The women in the study, most of whom were 50 or older, were treated initially with surgery and then followed for up to 20 years. Scientists determined that the 5-year risk of death from breast cancer fell from about 14% for women diagnosed in the 1990s to about 5% for women diagnosed later in the study. For example, among women diagnosed between 2010 and 2015, more than 6 in 10 had a 5-year death risk of 3% or less. The study was observational and merely suggests but doesn't prove that death risk has decreased in general. It also doesn't explain why the death risk dropped among women in the study. The scientists speculate that better treatments, improved imaging, and increased breast cancer awareness and screenings have contributed to the better outcomes. Men, women, and red meat risk is the last brief article. Advice to limit steaks, hamburgers, hot dogs, and other types of red meat to ward off heart disease and diabetes date back to the late 1970s. But the evidence against meat has been inconsistent, with some studies suggesting risk only from processed red meat like hot dogs, bacon, ham, and salami. Men tend to eat more meat than women. So which kind of red meat affects health? And is one sex more vulnerable to it than another? To find out, researchers reviewed dozens of observational randomized studies that tracked red meat consumption, including 43 studies looking at heart disease and 27 looking at diabetes, among more than 5 million men and women. The researchers found that both unprocessed and processed red meat are linked to a higher risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes, with no apparent difference in risk between men and women. The authors urge all adults to reduce their red meat intake as a way to protect health. Those findings were published June 2nd, 2023, in the European Heart Journal. There's a brief section that tells us how to measure your blood pressure. When you measure your blood pressure, you should always sit at a table with your arm resting comfortably on it, palm facing upward, your back straight, your feet flat on the floor. So in other words, don't cross your legs. If necessary, support your arm in a book or pillow. Place the blood pressure cuff around your bare upper arm. It should be snug, but it should not be tight. Remember, if it's too small, it will give you a falsely elevated blood pressure. Relax for 5 minutes and then take the first reading. Don't talk while you're taking your blood pressure. Wait 1 or 2 minutes and then take another reading. And you should write down the results in a log that you're going to use daily. Well, it looks like we're out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you enjoy it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at the website ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.